I'm author and critic David Agronoff. I'm a horror and science fiction author, critic, and researcher. In this podcast, I wanted to provide in-depth interviews and panel discussions with everyone from New York Times bestselling authors to researchers, musicians, and anyone I find interesting. Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World.
Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World, the fifth episode of the Science Fiction Hall of Fame series. And I've got a special panel of guests who I'm going to introduce in a moment. We're going to be covering Microcosmic God by Theodore Sturgeon. I have two announcements that I have to make because I am making rare public appearances in the middle of the country. I'm usually only on the West Coast, so this is a rare opportunity for those of you who live in the Midwest. And since this episode is coming out tomorrow from when we're recording this, it actually is in time. So I had to, and I'm sorry about the delay for the March episode here. I changed jobs and my schedule changed, and it's a whole long story. You don't need to know all that. But basically, I definitely wanted to wait to have this panel because we have a great one. Now, the first public event that's coming up, my new novel, my new science fiction horror novel, People's Park, about my hometown of Bloomington, Indiana, is out now from Choir Books. But we're doing the national book launch in Bloomington itself on April 7th at the Monroe County History Center. Folks in Indiana will know that's the old library where we used to have punk rock shows in the 80s in the basement before it became a history museum. And they're going to have a whole exhibit on punk at the old library. And in the conference room next door is going to be the book release party hosted by Professor D. Harlan Wilson, who wrote awesome books about J.G. Ballard and Alfred Bester. And my co-host now on the Dickheads podcast. So you can get 2/3 of the Dickheads podcast live in Indiana for the book release party. And then the other one we're both going to be at too is the Philip K. Dick Festival, June 13th through the 15th in Colorado. All the biggest Philip K. Dick scholars in the world are going to be there, from Umberto Rossi coming all the way from Italy, Lawrence Rickles, Greg Rickman, and I'm doing two presentations on the Philip K. Dick formula, based on the letter he wrote to Ron Goulart in 1965, and I'll be doing a preview of my upcoming book from the Exogenics Philip K. Dick study series called Unfinished PKD, about 17 unfinished outlines and fragments for novels he was working on before he died that he never finished. And so it's going to be a really awesome preview. I'm sorry, that's a lot of announcements that I made my guests sit through, but it's so rare that I'm going to be in the middle of the country. So today we're talking about Microcosmic God. Last time we did the Roads Must Roll by Robert Heinlein. We are now in our second story from the 1940s. And my guests today include Gary Wolf. Gary, tell the folks who you are and what you did, and congratulations on your Hugo nomination.
Well, that's one of the things I do. I do the Coon Street podcast with Jonathan Strawn, and much to our amazement, it's nominated for a Hugo again. But I've also edited science fiction books for the Library of America. I've written a few critical books, and I've been reviewing for Locus magazine for more than 30 years now. And by the way, speaking of announcements, Locus is running a fundraiser, which has only got a week to go. So pay attention to that.
Awesome. And Gary has podcasted with me before. We did a scholar panel during quarantine. And we also did an episode of Dickheads on Tony Boucher. And so I highly recommend you go check that one out. Of course, returning to Postcards from a Dying World after many, many visits. I can't go through all of Cora's visits. I call on her all the time. We did Lee Brackett's The Big Jump for Dickheads, and we did Chamblow, C.L. Moore, speaking of Indiana. Mm-hmm. Cora, welcome back to Postcards from a Dying World. Tell the folks who you are and what you do. Also Hugo
Well,
nominated
first
for a
of all,
few.
thanks for having me back. And well, my name is Cora Bulat. I'm from Bremen in North Germany. I'm a writer, teacher, and translator, and also science fiction scholar, critic, blogger. I'm also the 2022 winner of the Hugo Award for Best Fan Writer, and well, sort of a specialist in Golden Age science fiction, most particularly by women, but also in general.
Yeah, and I get lots of requests to have Cora back on all the time. So,
Well, you're always welcome to hit me up if you need another guest. Mostly we
and
can make something work.
yes, and you also joined us on this series already. You're the first repeat guest in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame because you were here for Stanley Weinbaum's Martian Odyssey, episode one. So, first returning guest for covering the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. Now, when I put the call out saying that, hey, who wants to come on and talk about Science Fiction Hall of Fame stories? One of the first people to write me was Bill Higgins. Bill, tell the folks who you are and what you do.
I'm a radiation safety physicist. I work at Fermilab, about west of Chicago, and I live in Aurora, Illinois. So by day I do physics, and the rest of my time I sometimes think about science fiction. I also do a lot of public speaking as a volunteer. I've volunteered for NASA for 25 years, and I'll come to your con or public library or astronomy club and tell you all about a Mars rover or an asteroid mission or some interesting topic in the history of science.
Yes, and also just love to research science fiction because you always send me interesting comments time to time on stuff I miss sometimes.
Yeah,
So I appreciate
I've
it.
contributed chapters to a couple of books on that touch on the history of science fiction, or kind of the crossroads between history of science and history of science fiction. So I've dealt with the history of how antimatter went from an obscure topic in nuclear physics in the 1930s to become an item in the toy box of science fiction writers. And this goes through John Campbell and Robert Heinlein and Jack Williamson and a few other writers. I did a biographical article about an obscure Manhattan Project scientist, Robert Cornog, who was a close friend of Robert Heinlein and definitely gave him some feedback at various points on physics and space flight and such.
Yeah, I know
And I'm
Campbell gets
looking.
some attention because he got some details that the government was a little, some of
Oh,
his writers got some details that people were a little sketched out about. So we're going to start off by talking about Sturgeon himself, and then we'll get into the story and the issue of Astounding itself that this was in, and of course the story. But Sturgeon is a very important figure in science fiction. Gary, you have collected and edited Sturgeon's work in the Science Fiction Classic series. Am I correct about that?
Well, the one of his novel, More Than Human,
More
is
Than
in
Human, right.
American science fiction of the 1950s, and I think that it's, I mean, it holds up very well. But what interests me, going back and looking at Microcosmic God, is that he was a kid when he wrote that. So this it's interesting when we go back and look at some of these classic science fiction stories. We think of these as kind of wise old masters. They were all kids. Asimov and Heinlein was what, 28 or something, and he was the grand old man of the group.
Right.
So looking at
Yeah,
Sturgeon's.
he was pleased at this point.
Yeah. So Sturgeon was actually born Edward Hamilton Waldo in Staten Island in 1918. So yes, he was quite young. And he changed his name legally to Theodore Sturgeon pretty young when he was 11 years old. So he knew he wanted to change his name. And that's partially because his mom remarried to William Dickey Sturgeon, And so, you know, he wanted to kind of associate himself family-wise with his stepfather. He had an estranged relationship with his biological father, similar to Stephen King, for example, as far as, because I kind of look for some of the, one of the things that we find with a lot of these writers in this era is that they were all sickly children who sat at home reading. And I hate to generalize, but it's true. A lot of them were, from Walter Tevis to C.L. Moore to Philip K. Dick. A lot of them were, you know, people, kids who sat at home and read because they couldn't go outside as much. And when you got sick back in the day compared to now, you know, one of the things they did was just keep you away from other people for long periods of time. And so Sturgeon's first short story sale was a story called Heavy Insurance in 1938. And he sold that. It appeared in the Milwaukee Journal. I don't know how he ended up selling to the Milwaukee Journal. But, you know, you do what you do. And his first pen name was E. Waldo Hunter. And so he was submitting so many stories in the early days that he had to use pen names because he was sometimes publishing multiple stories under other names in single issues of magazines. So he was pretty prolific from the beginning. I did not find like a ton about his childhood. And I'm not so sure it plays as much of a role as, for example, like John W. Campbell's whole situation with his mom and her twin sister, like obviously played psychological roles in how he was growing up. I don't know, does anybody else have anything biographical about Sturgeon?
Sturgeon wrote a really heartbreaking memoir called Argyle, A-R-G-Y-L-L, just the movie. And it's all about his really strained relationship with his father and his stepfather, both of whom completely disapproved of his artistic ambitions. It was published maybe 20 years ago or something like that. It reads just like Kafka's letter to his father. It's just this cry of agony. I can't get your approval for anything I do. And there's a passage in it where he just says, I write beautifully. Why can't you understand that? So he obviously had strained relationships, not only with his father, but with the stepfather as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you think it plays a role in any of the, because we see that Philip K. Dick's relationship with his mom, that you know, the lack of affection he got from her is throughout his fiction. I don't know. I don't know if I see it with Sturgeon.
Read a novel called The Dreaming Jewels, which is probably his most autobiographical novel. And it's about a kid who's just a complete outsider in the world.
And for that matter, is one I have not read.
So. Okay. And there's also a section of More Than Human that deals with kids who are outsiders, who are exiles and so forth. So yeah, the figure recurs. And his most famous horror story is called It, way back before Stephen King used the title, which is about a creature that just kind of spontaneously generates from garbage and stuff out in the woods. And it's a Frankenstein story. It's about this complete outsider that can't be accepted in society at all. So I think that almost was an obsession with him.
Well, and More Than Human, which is the one that you collected, a lot of people think of that as a progenitor to the X-Men in much way, in the way that the characters in the X-Men are exiled for being different and having these abilities. Of course, More Than Human was written so much earlier than any of that Stan Lee stuff.
The X-Men basically came from Golden Age science fiction, particularly the stuff published in Astounding. You'd find a lot of proto X-Men stories. There's Wilma H. Shire's Children of the Atom, which is basically the tagline of the X-Men. And there's a lot of proto X-Men because basically, sorry to, well, but in Lee and Stan Lee and Jack Kirby had read all of these stories and these magazines as young men.
And Van Vogt's Lan was...
of course, yes.
Yeah.
Which became so popular that there was this saying back in the 40s that fans are slans. In other words, fans completely identified with these outsiders.
And More Than Human is the most recent Sturgeon that I have reread. I reread it about maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. And I was struck by, you know, it's funny because Sturgeon was definitely in the zone. And I think that it is a masterpiece of that era. So if people are looking for, I mean, I liked, what was that? Venus Plus X. Yeah. Read also, which I liked, but I think More Than Human is really a high watermark for 50 science fiction, and I think the three parts of it work really well together. So if people haven't read that, More Than Human is, I think, a foundational it is canon, and I'm not just saying that because the guy who put it into canon really is sitting here. That one's collected with Brackett's Long Tomorrow, and what were the other two? The other books in that collection?
Ace Doubles.
No, in Gary's.
Gary's book. Yeah.
I should grab a copy of it and look. There was Heinlein's Double Star was in it. Fritz Leiber's The Big Time. See what else? I'd have to look at the book itself, actually.
Yeah,
Fred, the fabulous TLC at any rate.
Yeah, and it's a great way to that series is a great way to discover these books. You know, for example, like I'm pretty sure Matheson being collected with Lee Brackett, it's a great way to, you know, get a look at a survey of the genre in that era. So really wonderful editions.
There's also some Library of America editions of science fiction. Also, I think they do 50s, 60s, and so on.
Yeah, incredible work, Gary. And
thank you.
And so Sturgeon was very prolific in that 40s and 50s era specifically. He slowed down a little bit later on, but at the same time, he also wrote quite a few book reviews. He had over 400 book reviews, 120 short stories published in his lifetime, 11 novels, and of course his two scripts for Star Trek, which are probably one of the most famous things. And I do want to digress a little bit about, I gotta talk about the Star Trek in the elephant in the room for just a second, because when I went to the Roddenberry archives, I did a recently have an article coming out in Foundation about DC Fontana. And so I went in to the Roddenberry papers at UCLA, and the stuff with Sturgeon, that the correspondence with Sturgeon are absolutely hilarious. And one of the things is that the first one page outline that he sent for Amok Time, his most, you know, the episode where Spock, you know, has his whole, the Vulcan mating ritual and all that.
The episode that launched 1,000 fanfics.
Yes. His original, and I posted a picture of this the other day on Facebook, his original one-page idea, he literally titled it Spock Blows His Top, scratched it out, and handwrote Amok Time on it on purpose as a joke, which is very funny. And which was something that Gene Kuhn and I think it was Robert Justin. Yes, they both referred to it as Spock Blows His Top in a couple of the correspondence back and forth. So they actually really appreciated that. However, what was funny is they were very into the idea. They wrote it. One of the most important pieces of feedback that happened is he invented a character to have a crush on Spock, and it was DC Fontana who suggested that it needed to be Nurse Chapel, which of course still has ramifications on Strange New Worlds. And it was DC Fontana who had to communicate with Sturgeon when he was 2 months behind turning in the script. And apparently it was very frustrating for the staff there. But a lot of the things that people think are important about this episode were right there in that first one page draft. However, the Vulcan salute was an improvisation by Leonard Nimoy. So, but Live Long and Prosper was written by Theodore Sturgeon. So of course, one of the most famous things that he was known for was Sturgeon's Law, which is 90% of science fiction is crud, but then 90% of everything is crud, right? Mm-hmm. And then he, of course, said he also had Sturgeon's Revelation, which is nothing is absolutely so. And I think he's most famous. One of the things he's most famous for is that Sturgeon's Law. And I wonder if you guys have any thoughts on Sturgeon's Law.
Just that the story of Sturgeon's Law has been retold many times in many places. And so there's a fog of folklore about it. And I'm not really sure exactly where, when it originated. And, you know, I have a version that I like to tell, which is a reporter is interviewing Sturgeon about science fiction and you know, given the prevailing attitude of the times, he says, isn't it true, Mr. Sturgeon, that 9/10 of science fiction is crud? And in my version of the story, Sturgeon just strokes his chin and says, son, 9/10 of everything is crud.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. And it's kind of like that whole, like, you have to write a million words quote that, like, Ray Bradbury, Hemingway, a bunch of different writers have been given credit for saying it. And nobody really knows who originally said it because it was repeated so many times by other writers. I think Sturgeon's Law is one of those things that just gets repeated often. I would say the other. I haven't read everything, and that Dreaming Jewel sounds really fascinating. That's definitely gonna be the next one I'm gonna read. But I also would say his vampire novel, Some of Your Blood, is great, and is one of those masterpieces that I think not just science fiction readers but horror readers should definitely check out. Some of Your Blood, if you haven't.
There's a really odd story about how that novel Some of Your Blood came about, which I learned from Betty Ballantyne, who commissioned it. She asked Sturgeon to write it. It's kind of a vampire story, but it's based on an actual case history that had been written by a pop psychology writer named Lucy Freeman, who had bestsellers. She'd written a book based on a case history of somebody who'd been discharged from the army and was hospitalized in New York. And according to Betty, this person was being released from the hospital and knew that Lucy Freeman had written up his case history. So Freeman withdrew her book and said, I don't want you to publish it because this guy is dangerous and he knows who I am. So Betty canceled the book and said to Lucy, would you mind if I had one of our authors just write a novel based on these notes? And she called up Sturgeon because Sturgeon was like the go-to writer for Ballantyne books. A couple of years earlier, he'd written a novel called I, Libertine, which was a completely fake novel that had been invented by a radio host named Gene Shepard, who decided he was going to make fun of the publishing industry. So he started talking on his show about this controversial, wild historical novel in England called I, Libertine. And people started demanding it from libraries and bookstores. There was no such book. But the Ballantynes called Sturgeon up and said, why don't you write this book? And he did, and it's out there under the name of Frederick R. Ewing. And since they'd had that deal with him, they figured, okay, now we've got this weird vampire story we don't know what to do with. So they called him up again. So he was like the writer on call for Ballantyne Books in the 50s.
Yeah, and I think it's also taught as kind of canon in horror as well as science fiction. And I, you know, it's one of those rare ones, like Matheson is another one who kind of blurs both lines. The other thing, I'm not necessarily going to go big time into this, but also I think one of the things we have to mention is the whole Kurt Vonnegut connection, which is that, his fictional science fiction writer, Kilgore Trout, who, you know, Philip Jose Farmer brought to life a little bit, was, you know, obviously a play on Theodore Sturgeon. And, you know, I think Vonnegut was definitely a fan of Sturgeon and wanted to kind of pay tribute to him with that. And with that being said, let's get into the actual story. Let me share screen with you folks. So if you're on YouTube, if you're listening to the audio only, this is when we're going to look at the actual issue. So this is when it's good to have the YouTube version. So this is the cover of the issue. And we can see that this was April of 1941. And the cover story is Sprague DeCamp, who we've talked about a couple times in this series because he's always been astounding. And you know, collected alongside these stories. And so he's the cover story. So we're not even on the cover here with this Sturgeon story. And
actually have two classics, at least two in this issue. And the one that gets the cover is a fairly forgotten Elsbrecht de Camp. At any rate, I've never read it, so I can't say anything about this.
Yeah, I haven't read this one either. I don't know why, but I'm just... really,
I read part of this installment and decided not to continue. It was clear it's a satire of the corporate of a corporate future, and it's it might be interesting. It doesn't seem like DeCamp's best work, so I sort of skipped the rest of it.
Yeah, we have this Listerine for infectious dandruff ad that is a little dodgy. And then this Headhunters ad, which is very dodgy. Astounding had no control over the ads. We've talked about this many times, that the publisher sold them the ads and they just had to take what they got.
I always love these ads because they're so wonderfully weird.
Yes. So let's zoom in here a little bit. So DeCamp obviously starts off the issue, and then Microcosmic Goddess second. But we also have a Stone Cold classic by Isaac Asimov in Reason, which is one I've read before. And I've not read the A.E. Von Vogt, not the first, but this, I'm surprised that A.E. Von Vogt, I understand that Asimov had not really made his name yet. So I understand that he was not on the cover, but I'm surprised that Von Vogt in 41 wasn't established enough to be on the cover, and maybe he wasn't yet. I don't know the timeline for A.E. Von Vogt fandom, because this is obviously before Null A, which and Slan, which are the two that really were his big hits of the 40s, if I'm correct.
It's actually Black Destroyer, isn't it?
That might be, yeah, the one that really launches him. And we're actually going to be soon doing a trilogy episode for Dickheads where we cover World of Null A, Solar Lottery by Philip K. Dick, and The Gamesman by Barry Maltzberg, because they all consider each other pastiches of each other. Those three books. So we're going to do them together here coming up. So I'll be doing a bunch of A.E. Von Vogt research soon, but I haven't done it yet. Any thoughts on this table of contents, Cora? I know you always have a lot to say about the table of contents.
Yeah, well, we have a sort of it's the Astounding stock company, because Elsbrecht de Camp was in Astounding and also the sister magazine Unknown, which was already going by this time. Mm-hmm. By this time, a lot. I mean, one of his most famous works, Lest Darkness Fall, appeared in Unknown. And Sturgeon was also in Astounding and also sometimes Unknown a lot. Asimov never made it into Unknown, no matter how much he wanted to, but he was in Astounding a lot. And of course, this is a Stone Cold classic, Reason. Then we have Malcolm Jameson, who basically was, he was sort of the go-to filler guy. No one really remembers him very well, but he was in Astounding and Unknown all the time. He was also kind of forgettable. With A.E. Von Vogt, another, of course, very classic writer, who was on track to be one of the big three before he got distracted by Dianetics and Scientology, sadly. We have P. Shyla Miller, or however he pronounces himself, who's better remembered probably these days as a critic and reviewer, yeah. But he was also a writer. And he's the guy who wrote to Robert E. Howard, Howard asking for, as a teenage fan, asking for a chronology of the Conan stories and got a rough chronology back. So this is also something. Whenever I see his name, huh. I think like, oh, the guy with the Conan chronology. Yeah, then we have Harry Walton and Alice Richardson, who don't really ring a bell. And we have a guy called Kurt von Rachen. I'm pronouncing him in the German way now, whatever he wanted. Whom I also really am not very familiar with. I must look him up.
Yeah, the mutineers.
But he was apparently important enough to be the third build writer, after DeCamp and Sturgeon, and well ahead of Asimov or A. van Vogt or Schuyler Miller.
Yeah.
Also, Alice Richardson thing is a science article, I just noticed.
Right.
I have kind words for a couple of stories in this table of contents. Beyond reason is I think Asimov's second robot story, and he had not yet cooked up the three laws of robotics, so they get kind of bolted on later. I think when he collects.
I think it's in the next one. It's Powell and Donovan stories of yes, I think it's Powell. It's one of the early Powell and Donovan stories, mm-hmm. who were in turn inspired by some characters Campbell had created to some troubleshooters. And honestly, Powell, Donovan, and Susan Calvin TV show one day. We are getting foundations, so please give us Powell, Donovan, and Calvin robot troubleshooters.
Right, and Reason is one that has been collected many times, and I believe Reason was in Asimov's personal collection of his favorite stories, but I could be wrong about that.
Now, I just like the Malcolm Jameson, as you said, was a stalwart contributor and not among the top rank of science fiction writers, but solid. And I liked his story, Slacker's Paradise, in this. I thought it was pretty good. And he has a footnote at the end that says that it's based on an actual historical incident, which made it kind of intriguing. It's worth reading.
Yeah, this doesn't seem like a too bad of an issue. It's funny when you see other kind of classics floating around together in the same issue and think about, you know, kind of the zeitgeist of it.
Astounding could be a good illustration of Sturgeon's Law, because when Astounding was good and classic, it was very, very good indeed. But the crud, it was 90% for Astounding. But especially later in the 40s, you do get a lot of, even later, you do get a lot of crud, but which has never been reprinted. But usually the crud in Astounding is barely readable. Whereas, for example, for Weird Tales, where you also sometimes have three or four classics in one issue, maybe 5 years before this, but even the completely forgotten story in the Weird Tales, which is swashed somewhere between C.L. Moore and H.P. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard and maybe Clark Ashton Smith, and you have issues where all of them are, where you have every one of these, but even the forgotten story by an author no one ever heard of, of that stuck somewhere in between those classics, is usually readable. A lot of the not very, the bad Astounding stories usually were very bad, but this is definitely a very good issue, as an issue, even though I haven't actually gotten around to reading through all of it, simply due to this being a very busy weekend for me.
Well, and I didn't go through, and I usually look at like two or three issues out, like the letter columns, and I didn't do that this time.
The letter columns are always great. I love looking at the letter columns and seeing what contemporary correspondents thought about the stories.
Bill?
Yeah, I the sleeper story here for me is The Scrambler by Harry Walton, and I too am not familiar with Harry Walton. And it's not, it's, you know, assembled by pulpy conventional parts, but it has a concept. It's bringing a variation on a standard concept that I find is pretty ambitious for the author to tackle. There's there are many stories where somebody finds himself in somebody else's body. There's like the personality swap, right? We've all read stories like that or seen them on TV or whatever. In this story, the crew of a spaceship finds that they are swapped, that they are swapped in pairs. So Smith becomes Jones and Jones becomes Smith. And then this happens over and over again at random intervals. And the captain, and plus they have a serious problem that might doom the spaceship if they don't take care of it with their technical expertise. But, you know, do you even know who the astrogator is or who the engineer is? And at one point, a crucial member of the crew winds up inside the cat. And you know, he pulls it off it's a satisfying story. The ending is a little hokey, but I was impressed that the author was trying to do something so ambitious. And you know, I think it works reasonably well, and you know, points to Harry Walton for that.
Yes. And so you can see, for those who are interested in looking up the readers' departments, there's of course Campbell's essay. I looked at it briefly. The analytical laboratory, and there's some science pieces that are in there. So let's go ahead and
you passed the shadow. I wanted to mention shadow and I'm paying.
Yeah, you want to see the shadow?
It's
a radio drop. What's I think? There he is. The shadow.
Yeah.
Shadow's 10th anniversary.
The shadow knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men.
Huh. A weed of crime.
Yeah, there's a person who did this on the radio. Who was not.
All right.
No, who was not the famous person?
Microcosmic God starts here. So, let's get into this story. Had everyone was this? So we all obviously reread this story for this. When were you first introduced to this story? This was the first time read for me. So, but I'm wondering if anybody else had read it like long in the past. Gary, I'm assuming you have.
It seemed to me it was anthologized in every anthology in the 1950s. I mean, I can't even remember when I first read it. It may have been in Campbell's own Astounding Science Fiction Anthology, but it's been in textbooks. So I'm pretty sure it's never been out of print since sometime in the 40s in one anthology or another.
Yeah. Bill, you read this one before, I take it?
I looked up and found the anthology I read it in is a Groff Conklin tome called Giants Unleashed from 1964. And I encountered it in a library about 5 years later at the age of maybe, I don't know, 14 or so. There's a phase of your life when you figure out that there are anthologies and you start plowing your way through the shelf of the library and experience the short stories of, in my case, circa 1970, the short stories of the Golden Age, right, were collected in books and New Wave stuff was just beginning to come out. So I read this story. I always found it very memorable. I've read it multiple times over the years in multiple books, and I thought it was a great story.
Yeah. So before we get to Cora's history with it, mine is that I'd never read it before. I'd read Some of Your Blood and More Than Human have been on my shelf since I was a teenager, which I, you know, found him through Star Trek. But those two I always love, but I just never, I have not read much of Sturgeon's short fiction at all. So, Cora, you had read this before, I take it?
Or... Yeah. Also, as a teenager in some anthology, unfortunately, I can't remember which one it was because it's books were, especially English language import books, were very expensive. A lot of this stuff was translated into German, but the translations were also often dodgy and also not really easy to find because they'd been in magazine form. I'd have to look up who, but I'm pretty sure someone like Walter Ernsting translated this one because he translated most of them. So because books were English language books were expensive and the local library didn't really have science fiction anthologies, English language ones. So my dad was working in Rotterdam in the Netherlands at the time. There was a huge bookstore called Donner Buchen, which I still believe this building was built by Time Lords because it was like a 3 or 4 story building outside, but inside it had like 12 levels, which sort of floated around the courtyard. And the English language section was maybe 3 or 4 levels up. So they had a lot of science fiction books. So I just went there, took a book out, sat down. Well, they already had leather armchairs, which was quite rare in bookstores at the time. So if those were free, I sat down there. If they weren't free, I was like 15 or 16, I sat down on the concrete stairs, which went around this courtyard, and people would literally have to step over me while I was reading. And that's where I read a lot of, that's where I found Fafard and Gretel Grey Mauser, where I first found Eric John Stark, and that's also where I read Microcosmic God. But I looked through but there have been so many anthologies. I even looked through ones which would have been published around the same time to see if a cover rings a bell, but sadly it didn't. So I don't know which anthology it was. Just it was an anthology, and I discovered the story among lots of other good stuff. I don't know. And then when I had enough money together, I sometimes would buy a book. One of the first things I bought was the first edition Encyclopedia of Science Fiction by Jean Clute. Because, well, it was great. It stopped you from just grabbing things randomly off the shelf because it told you, like, okay, this is good, and so on. So, yeah, I still have that edition, by the way. It was hugely expensive at the time.
Yeah, I think sometimes with Pringle's Ultimate Guide to Science Fiction, but I almost always disagree with his reviews, so I stopped using.
I used it literally as a guide. I looked through, like, okay, this sounds kind of interesting, even if he apparently didn't. I actually disagree with him a lot as well. But but it was still a really useful guide, and I still have that. Still have that book.
Yeah, I mean, you give such a low rating to John Bruner on just about anything, I'm gonna check out on you. It's just the way it's gonna be.
What convinced me to give Brunner a try was an article fairly shortly after he died in SFX, a British science fiction magazine, which praised him. And so I said, like, okay, they say this guy is good. Well, let's give him another try. And
Well, Bruner's one that I'm surprised is not in here. What's that Thou Art Faithful novelette that he did in Astounding? That he wrote when he was like 15. I just think it's just phenomenal. But I'm a brunette, as they say, with Bruner. Let's get into this story. We always want to kind of go into like the tagline at the beginning of the story. Kidder had a system for inventing things in a hurry, and he thought he had a system for handling the results. His method was inhuman, but his agent was human and dangerous. The story is about a biochemist named Kidder, and some of the science, of course, is a little bit wackadoo as some of these old science fiction gets, as we say on the Dickheads podcast. But I'm all for wackadoo science. I don't care if it, you know, holds up entirely, because at a certain point, that kind of science fiction becomes surreal and fun. This Kidder and his whole, like, creating this pocket cosmos, I don't really know, you know, pocket cosmos has become very important to the science fiction I study as a Dickian, but I'm not so sure if Sturgeon was first or not to write about a pocket universe, but I'm assuming. Okay, who knows who really kind of did this first? Because I don't.
Well, if you want to go way back, I mean, the idea of microscopic worlds probably goes back to the first stories about microscopes. There's a famous story by Fitz James O'Brien in the 1850s called The Diamond Lens, which somebody is looking through a microscope. And this all came about because of the beginnings of the atomic theory, that an atom sort of looked like a world with a sun with orbits. So they figured, okay, maybe it is. But in The Diamond Lens, a guy looks through a microscope and he finds this beautiful girl in this microscopic world and falls in love with her. And that plot came up again. Oh, there was Ray Cummings, who was a pulp writer who started publishing even before Amazing Stories started, had a very famous story called The Girl in the Golden Atom. It was a classic of the early 20s. And it's, again, about a guy with a microscope who discovers an entire microscopic world and falls in love with a girl in it. And that became popular. Later on, I'm not sure. And then in the 30s, it came up again and again and again. And I think the idea of a microscopic civilization accelerating time was in an Edmund Hamilton story sometime, maybe in the late 20s. But there are three or four stories like this in the 30s that have been identified that set up the microscopic world as a separate world, and even one in which time.
Was where the first discovered via Hamilton was where I first discovered came across the concept, also with the atom which looks like a planet and so on. Ironically, not in his actual written work, but as a very very young kid, like of maybe 6, 7, 8 years old, via the Captain Future anime from Japan, which aired on German TV, and which is one of my foundational science fiction experiences long before I knew. The Captain Future books actually aren't all that great, but that anime series literally blew my mind as a very, very young kid.
And I think some of the early Captain Future stories were written by Edmund Hamilton.
Yeah, that's why I said it was via Hamilton, via Hamilton, because he wrote quite a few of the Captain Future stories. Mm-hmm. The stories are not really, really, really that great, and. But that anime series was really amazing, and sadly they never aired the whole thing on German TV because it also wasn't rerun for ages because it was much 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 too scary for poor little kids. After that, little Cora didn't want all the boring nice Heidi and so on cartoons anymore. I wanted more like that. Give me more Captain Future or stuff like that.
Right. Well, and this idea that Kidder was this inventor who, was studying how this quick microcosmic universe evolved, and, they live faster, so they get this technology. I think that's the concept here that's original, or that's, that kind of is the mind-blowing part of what's going on here for that Sturgeon's inventing. And of course, that's what this tagline plays on. But and I do think that Sturgeon is kind of playing with a neat concept here. And of course, one of the things I'm doing is, because one of the reasons why I wanted to do this series is talk about why these stories got chosen for here. Do they fit? Are they valid? And a lot of the times we're discussing this author had better stories here and there, but I so far, and I know I'm kind of getting ahead of the ball game, but I'm thinking this, it's clear that this story did have an impact or influence, right? And we'll talk more about that later, but Gary, your feelings on rereading this story now and experiencing the story again. Start us off.
I think one of the things that surprised me about it was that what Sturgeon really introduced to this microcosmic idea was the idea of control. So you've got somebody who is deliberately forcing these people to evolve. But the thing that struck me about it, which had not struck me at all when I was a kid, was that the two main characters in it are both just awful. They're horrible human beings. You've got this parody of an Old Testament God who's willing to torture and create wars and this sort of thing. And then he's working against the most predatory capitalist in the world. So in a way, now the story looks to me like, in some ways, more relevant than I expected it to be. It's about conscienceless science coming up against predatory capitalism. And that isn't exactly irrelevant these days.
Also, it wasn't irrelevant if you look at what at the time at which it was written. And he starts off with, "I'm not going to go political on you." The first line is literally, "Here's a story about a man who had too much power and a man who took too much. But don't worry, I'm not going political on you." This was written 1.5 years into World War II. Might be referring to Hitler, to Mussolini. And there's some quite chilling, as an adult, some quite really chilling parallels to the Third Reich with the terrible experiments. I literally wrote in my note somewhere this about Killer, this guy is Mengele. Because that's what he's doing. He's experimenting on living feelings, beings. And yes, I agree with Gary. He's terrible.
Yeah, in the sarcasm of that opening line, "I'm not going to get political on you, and then I'm going to write a very political story."
Then he goes super political.
Yeah.
But the sort of people who scream that X-Men is woke now, now with a new cartoon or so on, or that Star Trek was never woke before, they probably wouldn't get the sarcasm of that Theodore Sturgeon had here well before any of us were born.
Right.
I read that first line as possibly referring to FDR, because at this time there was a lot of discussion about FDR, getting a third term, having too much power. And I thought he was trying to deflect that kind of criticism, but he could easily have been referring to Hitler and Mussolini.
Yeah, probably. It depends on, Hitler is, when I think 1941, Hitler is obviously the first thing I think of in Germany. That's the first thing you think of. So I thought of course, it's also like all these stories were in the middle of World War. Well, it wasn't yet, the US hadn't yet entered World War II. You still had a couple of, still had about, what is it? Right. Was in December, so you still had 8 months to go. That's of course the obvious one I think of. Oh, Bill wants to say something.
Yes.
Yeah, there's more deflection going on in the second paragraph, I think that Sturgeon is signaling, among other things, that he's writing this for the experienced science fiction reader. His audience is people. He's saying this is a mad scientist story, but wait a minute, no, it's not really about a mad scientist. And he rattles off a few other cliches of such stories.
The megalomaniac with the Russian name and no scruples. That one had me giggling out loud because we all know that kind of mad scientist.
Right. So he's trying to tell you what kind of story this is not, to like make you more receptive to the story he does want to tell. That's the purpose of the paragraph, I guess. No, wait, this is not another one of those stories. Listen to me, let's start reading, keep reading the third paragraph and so forth. But indirectly, this paragraph, as I said, also signals that he's treating you as an experienced reader who's familiar with other science fiction.
Mm. Yeah, and I admit I read this story twice because I read it cold. I didn't know anything about it other than the title and that it's placed here in the SF Hall of Fame. And the first time I read it through, I was trying to kind of grasp onto the ideas. And then the second time through, I was kind of looking a little bit closer at what he was doing as a writer. And what I think that this, I was a little bit surprised that we were seeing him kind of invent this universe, because I was assuming that when I started reading it, I was assuming that he was finding a kind of existing pocket universe, but the fact that he was kind of creating it, I guess I should have seen that with the title, Microcosmic God. But I just thought he was going to be playing God. And so it's funny how when you come into something with your preconceived notions or whatever, Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting a flash flood warning, folks. So, in San Diego, which is very unusual. Sorry about that. What I'm saying is that I think that this story like holds up to multiple readings, because I think that a lot of times there are so many fundamentally cool details that he puts into the creation of this other species, the Neoteryx, right? That you could easily miss some of this stuff as it's going by, right? And I'm wondering.
I think one of the things, apart from the Neoteryx, who we don't really see much at all, we don't know what. I remember the first time I read this, I was thinking somebody ought to be writing a series from the point of view of the Neoteryx. Eventually, actually, Robert Charles Wilson eventually wrote a novel very much like that. But the other thing that struck me is this is a super genius who is, again, in modern terms, clearly somewhere on the spectrum. He can't deal with people. He's terrified of people. He's only comfortable with a world that he can completely control. In terms of science fiction invention, in the early couple of pages, this guy kind of offhandedly invents the fax machine. He described a kind of broadcast power that sounds a lot like fusion power. And this is just throwaway stuff that's not even what the Neoteryx invented.
There's a bit later on where the evil capitalist Conant blackmails the president, and we get a kind of little thing like, oh, New Washington was the prettiest, it was the most beautiful city in America. It was built on the ruins of Denver after the Great Western War. So we get all of these wonderful world building details. And I think like, okay, tell me about the Great Western War. Tell me about what happened to Denver. It's just a kind of offhand world building detail. And it didn't even have to be in there because the president basically just later on deals with a right. terrible capitalist list, but he could have just set it in regular old Washington and nothing would have changed. But he just chose to put all his wonderful world building details in there.
Yeah, I wanted more of that too. I was wondering what was going on with the book. I was like, oh, hey, we're going there now, as a person whose favorite subgenre of science fiction is the weird apocalypse novel, I was kind of, wanting to go there a bit more. But yeah, and you're right, that world building is, something that when it's introduced kind of comes out of left field at that point. And you're right, it could have been any Washington, any capital, But let's look at some of the, there's more illustrations further on here.
Charles Schneeman.
Yeah. We'll have to take this along, Kidder. Sorry,
you can't see
it our way.
Actually, that name means snowman in German.
Ah.
Yeah.
The snowman drew these.
Yeah, this one could have been actually out of an issue of The Shadow or something. It looks with the sinister heavies who look like really they stepped out of a vintage gangster movie.
Yeah, there's the teletype, communication, which is kind of funny, interesting that he has this technology that he can create this. I always love that in the out-of-date science fiction.
Yeah. Also, when the teletype first shows up to communicate with the Neoteryx as in their temples, so-called, because he's, I thought like, oh yeah, well, we're 40 science fiction, we've got teletype, we don't even have a fax. And of course, then he invents a fax.
It's fax, right.
Actually, there were the fax machine that we remember wasn't invented until it wasn't invented until the 1960s, but of course there were precursors, so it wasn't as if Sturgeon was inventing this from whole cloth, but he was definitely, let's say, on the right track. Also, another thing which Sturgeon, of course, couldn't have known, but in the first Indiana Jones movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indy refers to the Ark of the Covenant as it's a sort of two-way communication device with God. And that's literally what this teletype machine for the Neoteryx your texts. And of course, they have their own Ten Commandments. They write their own Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The word is holy, right? We are science fiction readers, and we consume our the product of our authors in the forms of words. And in this story, we have a temple where the words of a character are revered.
I think one of the things to keep in mind in terms of all these kind of throwaway tidbits of world building and inventions and so forth is that he was writing this very much under the influence of Campbell, and Campbell really wanted all of his stories to just have catalogs of things. Just throw as much scientific speculation into any story as you can.
Go ahead, Bill.
I'd like to spend some time on the role of science in the world building in this story. So I have a bit to say about it, and maybe this is not
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I want to get into the impact after that.
In the early pages, Sturgeon is telling us, or the narrator is telling us about Kidder, and he offers examples of Kidder's career, like here's some things he invented, and it starts with synthesizing vitamin B1 in ton lots. Okay, well, that's not, if you're not a chemist, you don't know whether that's hard or easy, but okay, making chemicals. And the next thing is a miracle fiber, which is just a completely plausible 1930s science thing that you might have read about in the newspapers, science writing. He is building, and then we get the rapid fire PowerPoint list of many inventions. Okay, just to show you that Kidder is a really clever guy and he can work in a variety of fields. This is a staircase. Sturgeon shows you something that's pretty plausible and something else, the B1, and then the miracle fiber, which is also pretty plausible, and then a bunch of other inventions which are somewhat more fantastic, but you could perhaps imagine that they'd be in popular mechanics or something. And he is trying to establish that that Kidder is an inventive genius, and he is building building your acceptance of this proposition. And by the time the third or fourth page has gone by, there's this just like long list you realize Kidder is very quite advanced, and who knows what he's going to do next, which Laura. Is the right thing in the mind. Laura?
Yeah, I also noticed these early steps, and one that really struck me was that he invited a kind of steel wire cable, which they already had at the time, and there was a description of a demonstration of a truck hanging across Niagara Falls. And I actually tried to look up if this was a real thing, because it sounds like this was a real demonstration done sometimes. Because, a lot of science in any kind of astounding is crud and it's nonsense, but a lot of it in technobabble, but there's also stuff which is rooted in the actual cutting-edge science of the day. For example, in the Foundation stories, a bit with the radioactive gold, which is synthesized, that was an actual experiment in the 1940s. And yeah, I really impressed my chemistry teacher in the school by knowing about this. So I thought, this sounds like something that was really done, but I couldn't find anything, because if you enter truck over Niagara Falls, you get umpteen photos of accidents of idiotic truck drivers driving off the, what's it called, Rainbow Bridge, or the bridge between Canada and the US and hanging over Niagara Falls. So, but it sounds real. And also the weird obsession with making stronger aluminum. Aluminum was, of course, during this is the ramp up to World War II in the US, and it's already World War II in Europe. So aluminum was a really important material because it's very lightweight. It's good for planes and everything, but you need to harden it. So this was all, the first things are based on, actual science of the day, even though I didn't look up who was the first to synthesize vitamin B1. And then they get into the really weird, weird stuff.
Yeah, but by the time this section is finished, you're ready to buy that this guy really is a genius, and that maybe he'll do something really amazing later in the story. And I find that actually this staircase thing happens again as in a later passage. Sturgeon's describing Kidder's efforts to make artificial life, and again, there's a description of experiments that go from the simple to the complex. So the reader is following him through this process. He just doesn't simply come out with a creature in a test tube one day. And there's a third staircase later in the story as the Neoterics get better and better at science and invention and solve problem after problem that Kidder poses for them and go way beyond human technology into a list of fantastic and impossible inventions by the standards of 1930 science. But by that time, you know, he has a complete explanation, a logical explanation for why these impossible things have gotten invented. He's done this plausibility building staircase at least three times.
I see Gary has his book out.
I have my book out because one of the lines that jumped out at me about this guy being a universal genius, and you know, that's an old cliche from 30s pulp magazines. But the line is, Kidder was a genius, granted, but his genius was not creative. He was to the core a student. He applied what he knew, what he saw, and what he was taught. In other words, the guy is not imaginative at all, which is setting up why he needs the Neoterics, because he can't really invent anything. He can only solve problems that are presented to him, which is a kind of interesting view of science as being nothing but applied science. In other words, the idea that he's simply responding to demands in the world. There's another interesting thing which I want to get to later, and that is Alec Neville Lee's theory about this story. Because in his book Astounding, Neville Lee described this as, I've got that here too, as the most spellbinding story that Campbell published during his entire editorship, which is kind of strong praise for it in a way. But Neville Lee kind of sees the story as enormously appealing to Campbell and enormously appealing to the readership, because in some ways it's a story about Campbell editing Astounding. It's a story about an editor who demands things of his writers, who puts pressure on them, who says you have to invent these things. And in Neville Lee's account, which is certainly well-researched, Kidder is a lot like Campbell. He can't really invent much himself, but he can force other people to come up with ideas.
Yeah.
And the response to the story in Astounding was phenomenal, apparently. It was one of the most popular.
And Sturgeon didn't like writing for Campbell.
Sturgeon didn't like the story very much, in fact.
Yeah. And so, that's an interesting thing. It's funny, I've got an interview coming up for Dickheads. We're getting Barry Maltzberg back on the podcast. For whatever reason, Barry said that he wants to talk a lot about old Hugo a lot this time. It's one of the things he said to me in the email. So we're going to have a lot of Gernsback talk coming up, I guess. I think what you bring up is very fascinating. And I had actually circled in my notes Alex's quote, so you beat me to it. That was the last thing in my notes.
Okay.
And I got to say that... that analogy, I think is spot on. And it's funny, I wonder if Campbell got it. I wonder if he figured out that he was being talked about there. But, you know, it's hard to say. And
one of the great mysteries, and Cora, you've done reading in this too, but I think one of the great mysteries of Golden Age science fiction is just how dense Campbell could be.
I mean, Campbell was a lot of the writers made fun of him, not just in
Astounding.
I mean, Lee Brackett literally called called a character Campbell, who's a kind of revolutionary character and who's black. And Campbell, we know, was somewhat racist. So yeah, it's a lot of them made think. Actually, also think I pretty much think Campbell didn't get it. Alec Nevada Lee is spot on here. Campbell is a vengeful god who is helsing his authors, and but Sturton also packed the story so much with tropes and things that Campbell liked. We have the science, we have the fantastic science, we have the technobubble, we have the competent Campbellian man who is both implied to be autistic and who is quite likely implied to be gay. I mean, we know how the story ends. He finds his person, and of course Sturton was gay, I think.
He was bisexual, and, at least.
He was bisexual, but writers made a game out of sneaking things past Campbell and past his assistant Kate Tarrant. Please don't forget Miss Tarrant. She was there before Campbell. She was there after Campbell.
Right.
Campbell. She was. If we still had Retro Hugos, I would push her for the best editor Retro Hugo. So Astounding can still get a Retro Hugo, but Campbell had enough real ones. So authors like sneaking things past Campbell, and Sturgeon quite literally did it here. And also, of course, the criticism of religion is something that also really resonated with Campbell. I mean, we see it all we see it in Foundation, we see it in Lest Darkness Fall by Elsbrecht de Camp. We have it in Gaza Darkness, which is one of the angriest anti-religious stories in anything Campbell published, by Fritz Leiber. And here we also have basically the question the story also asks is like, are we maybe the Neoterics? And is the God that a lot of people worship, the Judeo-Christian Islamic God, is that just some kind of scientist who only wants to speed up his inventions? So yeah, this is really, he hit all of the chords that Campbell liked and made fun of him.
And the idea of just throwing out one SF idea after another is not characteristic of other Sturgeon stories at all. He focused much more on character. One of the reasons he was upset at the reception of the story was he'd written it fairly rapidly. He'd written it to satisfy what Campbell wanted. And he didn't spend a lot of time on prose. He was very proud of his stylistic maturation at this point.
Still very well written, I think. I've read a lot of Astounding of the period. This is still a very well written story by Astounding standards.
Yeah, that's true.
Because the clunky prose in Astounding is legendary. Yeah, but I actually had a lot of quotes. I quoted a lot of things here because it's funny. It's great. It's easy to read. Even the technobabble sections are funny.
That's true.
And I hate to, we could talk three times as long on this, but I try to keep these to about an hour and 15, hour and 20. And this story just has so much that's so easy to talk so long about it. Plus, and I'm sorry if it's coming off on the microphone, but we are getting more rain in San Diego in the last 10 minutes than we have gotten in 10 years. So it's like pounding outside my window, and I'm thinking, I don't hear it at all, actually. Yeah.
I don't. Well,
I'm glad you're not all hearing that. So let's talk about the impact really quick. The impact that this story had. I think it fits in the Hall of Fame. I think it deserves to be here. I think it's funny that it's not really typical of Sturgeon's style, as you say, Gary. But I think it's obviously had an impact, and I think it fits here. So starting with Cora, do you think this story is the accurate representation for Sturgeon?
Well, it's not a typical Sturgeon story, but it's a great story. I also think it really deserves to be there. And also, I try to think of a better Sturgeon, but a lot of the ones I think of are either novels or the things like Killdozer, which is way too long for this one. So Sturgeon might not have liked it very much, and it's not a typical Sturgeon story, but it's a very good story, and one which clearly, which is also very illustrative of what Astounding was like at its best in the 1940s. This is a 10% story, to quote Sturgeon's Law.
High praise.
Bill, its place in the canon. What do you think?
Well, I did look at the letters column in the June 1941 issue, and there's only one letter that mentions it, and the reader praises it pretty highly. He says, Sturgeon is rapidly becoming one of your best writers, but there's not a lot of other discussion of it in the pages of Astounding. It scored number one in the analytical laboratory when the reader's poll was published a couple of months later. So people liked it at the time. Sam Moskowitz seems to have the impression that it made a big splash among fans of the time. And he doesn't really document that, but you know, he was reading fanzines and going to fanzines.
Yeah. I think it probably got discussed in the fanzines.
Yeah. And later on, well, I think the evidence that people keep anthologizing it, for decades is probably, I guess we didn't, this Don Wolheim, I think, was the first to anthologize it because the first paperback anthology of science fiction.
Oh, the Pocketbook of Science Fiction.
Yeah. And the David, you want to introduce the great fact about this book?
You know, I say it all the time on the podcast. Yes. That is the first time the word science fiction was on the cover of a paperback book. And of course, we had the experience on Dickheads of Betsy Wolheim going, you mean that print right there that was on her wall, which was, pretty cool. But yes.
Definitely
listen to my podcast because I point that out every time we talk about Wolheim and that book.
There was a woman who had a copy of this in her car because she was waiting to pick her kid. And the kid saw it and was intrigued by the rockets on the cover and so forth. So he started reading it. And the kid was Gene Wolfe and the woman was Gene Wolfe's mother. And Microcosmic God is the first science fiction story that Gene Wolfe ever read. Liked it a lot and kept on reading more of that stuff.
My memory hole because I'm writing an article for Amazing Stories about a science fiction writer's first encounter with science fiction. So I will keep that.
That's a really good first encounter for most of us. Yeah. It was probably a lot worse than this.
The other half of that Gene Wolfe quote is that it was the first science fiction story I ever read, and sometimes I think it's been downhill since then. So he liked it a lot.
Right.
It's a cheap joke, but there's a grain of truth in it.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Wolfs, Gary Wolfe, what do you think about this story in the canon of science fiction?
I think it became a touchstone for a lot of, not only for what it does, but for its thesis, which again, I think is one of the things that Sturgeon wanted to emphasize. He wanted to create a kind of Superman who is a purely intellectual Superman, who's not a stalwart pulp hero, but a kind of reclusive, nerdish guy, somebody that science fiction readers of the time could identify with. And that certainly has stayed with the genre. But I think what the other interesting thing is, he doesn't really make a hero out of this character in the end. The thing I think that keeps the story going, and again, this struck me more strongly rereading it this time, is that it's a completely ambiguous ending. You don't know what's going to happen. So you have this theme of something is going to happen, but we don't know what it is. Well, that's the theme, basically that's the theme of Arthur Clarke's The Sentinel, which, became 2001. There's this message that we have sent to outer space. That turns out to be a theme of the three-body problem. Something is going to happen. So that idea of an unknown future kind of sealed in a dome at the end of the story is still around there. The one novel I mentioned it earlier, and I'll plug it now. The one novel which I think is a direct response to this is Robert Charles Wilson's Spin, because Spin begins with the stars blinking out, just as they do, as a matter of fact, in the three-body problem. and a dome has been set around the world by aliens, completely sealing Earth off from the rest of the universe. And for every, and we discover that for every year that passes on Earth, it's something like 100,000 years pass outside the dome. So Earth scientists colonize Mars, they create a civilization on Mars, and they use the Martian civilization in exactly the same way that the Neoterics are used in this. So it's, in other words, it's a complete inversion of the story, but with the same idea. And also, domes are just a cool thing in science fiction. If you start naming science fiction domes, starting with this one, think of them, including Stephen King.
Not his finest work, if you ask me.
Not his finest work, but, you know, and not the best dome either.
Yeah, Bill.
I'd like to briefly mention, anyway, a thing that's obviously missing from this story. And if this story were written today or any time, maybe in the last five decades, the author would have looked at the suffering of the Neoterics. Mm-hmm. And the story would have been more about them or their relation with Kidder or whatever. And this story just sort of, while it describes the cruelty pretty well, it just doesn't empathize at all with these race of oppressed creatures. And that's a little surprising. And it's not the way that the approach that I think a modern writer would take, or even maybe latest version.
Right.
I just had the experience reading Charles Beaumont's The Intruder, right? And like, you would never have a novel written entirely from the perspective of the, you know, white power guy coming to town who's right. Like leading the fight against segregation. You at you know, and 80 pages of his point of view before you get any point of view from any person of color in the novel. It was really jarring to read right now, you know. Listen, I gotta wrap things up. So the thing about these panels, it's always fascinating to me to get these crews together because we have so much amazing point of view and intellect, and this panel did not disappoint. You all three are awesome. You're of course welcome back in future episodes of the Science Fiction Hall of Fame series. We got one of these a month coming up, so we're doing Nightfall next, and
that's a Stone Cold classic.
Yes. And I have some interesting things planned for the panel if the people I am planning come together. It should be pretty good. We'll see. Plans don't always work out, but we're going to do Nightfall next, and then we got A.E. Von Vogt, the Weapon Shop, after that. So some fun stuff coming up on this series. Starting with Gary, how can folks find you and your podcast and your current work? Gary, tell them what's up.
I guess the thing to do is to read Locus Magazine for my reviews, or Locus Online, and the Coot Street Podcast is, I don't know, you find it wherever you find podcasts. Isn't that what they say?
Yes. Yeah, so it is always fun for me as a person who listens to the Coot Street Podcast to be able to actually ask you a question instead of just hearing your voice. So, which is fun. Bill, I follow you on Twitter. You're a good follow on Twitter, or X, or whatever they call it, whatever Kidder is calling Twitter these days. Oh, I'm sorry, Musk. Bill, what have you got for the folks?
Yeah, Twitter is in decline. I am Mr. Beam Jockey, MrBeamJockey on Twitter. And I'm also active these days on Blue Sky, where I actually managed to snag the identity Beam Jockey. I used to shepherd particle beams a long time ago, and so that's my sobriquet.
Yes. Cora.
Well, you can find me at www.corabulert.com, which is my blog and website. You can also find me on all the social media places, Twitter, Blue Sky, Threads, Wandering Shop. What is it called now? Mastodon. Wandering Shop is just the subdomain. Mm. Also at under Cora Bulert. Bulert, C-O-R-A-B-U-H-L-E-R-T. And you can find me on also at Galactic Journey, which is a fanzine like any other, except that we live 55 years in the past. So it's 1969. The moon landing is coming up, and we're at the height of the new wave. And actually just had an article there looking at all of the old Robert E. Howard stories that came back into print in the wake of the success of the Conan reprints. And earlier I had, and a few weeks, I think 2 weeks ago or so, I had part of our review columns. I reviewed Slaughterhouse-5 by Kurt Vonnegut, which of course also includes Sturgeon's alter ego, Kilgore Trout. And the other one I reviewed was The Face in the Frost by Lon Balaerts, which is a sort of semi-forgotten but very good fantasy novel, mostly remembered for being part of the infamous Appendix N of the original Dungeons and Dragons handbook. So yeah, you can also find me at Galactic Journey for, well, insights into science fiction of 55 years ago.
All right, folks, thank you for joining us on another Science Fiction Hall of Fame episode. I will be briefly in public to be seen with my new book, People's Park. I hope people will check that out. If you listen to this podcast all the time, you should be able to know how to find me. Now, if you do want the special edition of this, it has a bunch of bonus features. You got to buy it directly from me, but otherwise you can buy it from Amazon or anywhere books are sold. And also just another shout out for my last novel before that, The Last Night to Kill Nazis, is available nationwide at Barnes and Nobles. It's my first nationally distributed novel. So if you hate Nazis but like vampires, it's the perfect book for you. So definitely I appreciate people checking that out and sending me pictures of it on the shelf around the country at Barnes and Nobles. That's really cool for me. On that note, folks, we'll see you next time. A lot of good stuff coming up on Dickheads that you should be interested in. We're doing two Barry Maltzberg specials, including the interview with Barry, which should be awesome. We don't get to talk to too many people who were active in the new wave like that anymore. And, you know, we're teaching him how to do Zoom and getting him on here. And it should be really fun. So definitely check that one out. And folks, thanks for joining us on the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. And this was a really good episode. I really appreciate it. Thanks.